Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, taking a walk has all kinds of benefits, and we'll talk about them with our first guest today. With us from Ireland is Shane O'Mara. He is a professor of experimental brain research at Trinity College in Dublin and a Wellcome Trust senior investigator. He's got a new book out. It's called In Praise of Walking, A New Scientific Exploration. In it, he takes a close look at our amazing ability to walk and what it does for you and I mentally and physically. So, are you a walker? Why do you choose to do it? I hope you'll join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Shane O'Mara, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It's great to be with you, Larry. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I tell you what, from reading your book, it sounds like you've been a walker for a long time. And I'm just wondering, what difference has it made in your life?
It's difficult to know where to start or end. So let's keep it brief and say that whenever I'm down, a walk lifts me up. Whenever I need to clear my head, a walk does it for me. Whenever I need to think about something, a walk does it for me. Whenever I want to enjoy company, a walk does it for me. A walk has been one of those things that I've always enjoyed. And I regret that it took me so long to get around to even thinking about writing this book.
Yeah, I wondered what finally tipped you over the edge. What inspired you to put this book together?
Well, you know, it's one of those funny things. Ideas come to you from other people. You say something that's obvious to them, and that's what happened in this case. I was meeting somebody. I had just done a big walk, maybe about an hour and a half or 2 hours duration, from North London to the center of London. I was over for a scientific meeting. And the person I was meeting said, "Why don't you write a book on walking?" And I thought, "Oh my God, I should write a book on walking." And that's literally how it came about. It was an idea that was so close to me that I couldn't see it.
Well, I tell you what, In Praise of Walking, which is the title of your book, I saw that book and I thought, what the heck can you write about for walking? And then I read your book and it is fascinating and a fun read. And thank you for writing it, as a matter of fact. And I learned a lot of things. Many have come up with ideas about what makes us as humans different from other creatures. So maybe you could start with that. Tell us your take on that.
Yeah, so humans are bipedal. Now, we're not uniquely bipedal. So bipedal means to walk on two limbs. Penguins, for example, walk on two limbs, but they have very different feet from us and they don't have knees. So they waddle in a very peculiar kind of way. And what we have is a very unusual anatomy where, as far as our brain is concerned, our body is hung from our skull and it makes contact with the ground. And our the way we walk has freed our hands for gesture, for pointing, for carrying things. We have a very mobile head and we have a body that is really remarkably adapted to walking. And here's a simple way of thinking about that. If you take somebody who's, let's say, in their middle age, you know, maybe early 60s or whatever, and you get them to do a long walk, multi-day walk, let's say 800, 1200 miles, something of that order, you will adapt remarkably quickly. You will adapt typically in the order of about a week to an endurance walk of that type. However, if you take that same person and you try to get them to adapt to running a marathon, you'll find that it takes maybe 12, 14, 16, 18 more weeks or even 24 weeks or whatever of training to adapt to that one shot event. Humans can walk 10, 15 miles a day, day in, day out. We adapt to it and we profit from it. And we have a body and brain that are designed to facilitate that kind of activity. And we've eliminated it from our everyday life.
Yeah, for a lot of people, not for me. I'm a kindred spirit with you. I do a lot of walking every single day. even in this pandemic time. In fact, because of it.
Yeah, even more so, you know, when we're trapped in the ways that we are, to stop the walls closing in, getting out and going for a good belter of a walk, feeling the sun on your face, or indeed, as we often get here in Dublin, the rain on your face, is a really, really important thing to do.
Well, is it a kind of instinctive thing? How do we know how to walk?
Yeah, so walking is really remarkable. So if you compare it to other human capacities, language is something that humans, of course, have a special facility for. But to learn to speak, you have to be exposed to a language community. And we know from cases of childhood abuse, for example, where children have been locked away and not spoken to, or in the case of the occasional feral child, not being exposed to a language community before about the age of 7 results in a lifelong problem in using language. You will find it very, very difficult to be articulate in the way that we, the rest of us who've been exposed to a language community, are. However, walking is somewhat different. All you need is motor experience. In other words, you need to just have the experience of being placed on the ground, crawling at first, learning how to navigate in that stable position. And at around about 12 months or so of age, you will start to pull yourself up and you will start to totter. You'll practice an awful lot. You'll do maybe 2,000 steps an hour. You'll flop down a lot on your bum. You maybe slip backwards maybe 17 times or so an hour on average. But by the age of 18 months or so, for the average child, you'll be a very, very proficient walker. So this is a very, very peculiar developmental thing to go through. Whereas a foal, when it's born, soon after it's born, it's running around. It's a preternatural runner. Humans spend a lot of time doing it, but we don't need to be taught to do it.
Yeah, interesting. Sandra in Libertyville, Illinois, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, Larry. Good to talk to you. I'm calling in because I wanted to share the fact, and it's a tough one to say, but I'm 70 years old and I suffer from depression. And I've dealt with it in many ways over a long period of time. And the research is out that movement, walking, exercise is almost better than medication for a lot of people. So with COVID, I really felt myself spiraling down and started walking 2 miles a day, once a day, and now I'm walking about 8 miles a day, twice a day, nonstop, every day. I'm lucky to have an incredible forest preserve system. So I meet deer, I meet squirrels, I meet weasels, I meet people, and it has changed my life. It is, and I'm fit. I'm incredibly fit. I thought I had to jog and do something high impact, but I'm finding I'm strong, I'm fit, I'm healthy. So there's so many benefits to it, which I just wanted to share.
Oh, Sandra, thank you so much for calling. And you touch, Sandra touches on kind of like at least three different areas that you talk about in your book. Go ahead.
Yeah, she does.
Doesn't she?
She's hit on all sorts of things there that are really, really important. The first thing we know is that movement is vital for humans. And many studies have now shown that people who move more, who walk more, are less likely to succumb to major depressive disorder. And obviously what Sandra is doing is a kind of self-therapy through movement, which is wonderful to hear. And 16 miles a day is kind of the order that I've mentioned already, that humans can walk without too much trouble. We can adapt to that very easily. But she said something really important, which is that she does it in nature. And there's an immense body of literature now showing that being exposed to nature and having regular sessions in nature is psychologically important for humans. It's psychologically resetting. And we know from many, many studies conducted all over the world that people who get regular doses of nature are much less likely to succumb to depression than people who don't get those regular doses of nature. So what Sandra's doing is very, very good for her psychologically, quite apart from the wonderful metabolic effects that she's giving herself from all of this walking.
And she did mention, too, that the whole business about running versus walking, and you can get pretty darn fit just walking, and probably it's easier on your joints, your knees, for example.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things to say about that. Now, I don't want to come across as somebody who's anti-running. I'm not by
right,
any means.
Running
is your thing. Please do it. But if you want to get fit walking, the recipe is pretty straightforward, actually. It's walk at a sufficient speed that talking to another individual is hard. So that's probably of the order of about 6 or 6.2 kilometers an hour. Maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more, depending on your height and weight. And to keep that up for 30 to 40 minutes. And that really imposes the kind of strain that will give you the kind of health and aerobic benefits of walking. But there is one interesting thing, and you've said it already about running. Runners get injured a lot. And from what we can tell, the rate of injury does not rise per million steps walked, but it does rise per million steps run. Running can be risky, especially if you're not running on surfaces that we're adapted to. So if you look at the human foot, we typically run using running shoes of some description. But if you look at somebody who runs barefoot, where you strike the ground is very, very different with barefoot running compared to running when you're wearing shoes, where you strike with your heel. So you give yourself much more of a kind of a thump through your body when you heel strike, as opposed to ball of foot and side of foot striking. And of course, we didn't have running shoes in Africa. You know, 60,000 years ago, we ran barefoot. Running, I think, is if it's your thing, that's great. But don't overlook the advantages that are easily gotten from walking, for which all you need is a good pair of shoes.
Absolutely. Sandra, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Our guest today, Shane O'Mara, professor of experimental brain research at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. And his new book is called In Praise of Walking, A New Scientific Exploration. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you, my friends, are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Shane O'Mara, author of In Praise of Walking, A New Scientific Exploration. Experience to share or question to ask, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Why do you like to walk, or why don't you walk? Love to hear from you, so give a call or shoot us a note on emails. Well, we've got lots that we can talk about. Oh, you know, you were talking about years and years back. You have a story about OTZI? O-T-Z-I?
Yeah, OTZI, the Iceman. So this is a great but sad story, I guess, if you're OTZI, but he's achieved a kind of an immortality in a strange kind of way. So I have two OTZIs in the book. One is one from 5,000 years ago. And this poor chap was walking on what is now known as the Via Alpina, which courses across northern Italy and southern Austria and places like that. It's about 1,200 kilometers long. And he was attacked, savagely attacked. In fact, he has some terrible wounds to his shoulder, and he clearly was shot with a bow and arrow and collapsed into a gorge where he bled out and was frozen in sight. But due, I guess, to some degree of global warming in that area, the glacier that he was in revealed him. And he was found by a couple who were out walking, and he has been extensively investigated. His diet has been dissected and all of those kinds of things. And in the kind of modern day version of OTZI, a group of researchers in Italy took a 62-year-old man and had him walk the Via Alpina. Again, this 1,200 miles that I've mentioned. Much of it, several thousand feet above sea level. And the remarkable thing is our modern-day Oitzi adapted within a very, very short period to the rigors of the walk. He became very adept at breathing the lowered concentration of oxygen, and all of his physiological parameters to do with heart disease and all of these kinds of things all improved really, really dramatically and very, very quickly. And this is kind of my general point about doing lots of extended walking. And Sandra is a great example of that, doing 16 miles a day. This is something that humans are really well adapted to doing. And you see, you know, if you go back and look at records from the late 1800s, the late 19th century, you'll find, for example, that workmen in London typically walked 4 to 5 miles to work and 4 to 5 miles from work, in addition to whatever walking they did during the course of their work. So, you know, 8 to 10 miles a day, every day. And we see people who live what are sometimes called ancestral lifestyles. So in the Amazonian jungle or in parts of Africa, the males walk up the order of 12 to 15 or more kilometers a day, food sourcing. Mm-hmm. And the females do sort of 10 to 12 kilometers a day. So it's something that we can do, but it's something we've kind of engineered out of our lives, especially since the motor car came along.
Yeah, and I think your point about heart, you do talk about health, and it is very possible to strengthen your heart through walking.
Well, so there's been a couple of really interesting pieces of work on this, and the extended walking seems to be the thing. So a group in Sweden, for example, have studied people walking the Camino, which is the big pilgrimage in Spain. And they took a mixed group of males and females in their late 60s and upward who did 780 kilometers of the Camino. So that's, you know, of the order of 500 miles walking. And in, again, a remarkably quick turnaround, the kind of factors in the blood that are associated with heart disease dropped dramatically, and the factors in the blood that are associated with kind of positive cardiovascular health went upward very, very quickly, reflecting exactly the same experience that our modern day Oitzi had in the Alps. Doing lots and lots of extended walking is really good for you.
Well, I think Linda in Sheboygan has a question relating kind of to this. Linda, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering about something. I have an illness that has really made my legs very, very, very weak. And it has been suggested to me to walk like 3 minutes a day in my home a few times a day. And I'm wondering what the speaker has to comment on that method of building up my endurance.
Starting out, okay, so Linda's in a situation where she has to really start with a short amount. What do you think about that approach, Shane?
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think, you know, what you have to do is listen to your body, you know. If you find, for example, let's just pick on an example. If it's a respiratory complaint and you find breathing difficult, well, what you do is you walk to the point where you're able to walk comfortably, but not uncomfortably. So you're not suffering from what's known as dyspnea, which is the feeling of unpleasantness that you get from shortness of breath. And building yourself up gradually like that is obviously the way to go. Jumping in at the deep end and trying to walk for an hour or two would not be medically advisable.
Yeah. So I think it's a great way to start, Linda. And perhaps as you are able and do it more often, you'll be able to extend that to longer periods of time, perhaps.
Yeah, and probably what Linda should be thinking about doing is talking through this with her physician.
Yes.
And tracking the number of steps that she's doing. You know, just getting things like her blood oxygen measured regularly, so which is very easy these days, just so that on the medical side of things, she's not doing anything that might be risky for her.
Yeah, absolutely. Linda, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And of course, a great way to keep track is with your smartphone. If you have a smartphone, And it,
that, yes, turn it on. Turn on the pedometer. It's there. It's in your pocket. And it tells us all sorts of interesting things. And we now know, for example, from your smartphone, just how much walking people do. And it's not very much, unfortunately. In Western Europe and North America, typically people walk of the order of about 4 to 5,000 steps a day, which isn't so much. But there's marked variation within countries. So people in New York walk much more than that, as do people in San Francisco, because these are very dense, built-up areas. And the same is true in Western Europe. If you're living in London or in Dublin, you will walk a lot simply because of the nature of the environment. And we know the Japanese are the best walkers on the planet. They put in around about 6 to 6,500 steps a day. There's something remarkable about Japan, which is if you look at pictures of Tokyo or the other big cities, you'll see there's no on-street car parking. People have to go around on foot because their islands are very small and they have an enormous population packed into them.
It is indeed interesting. And the walking, it's kind of surprising now. Our health experts here, at least the recommendations I have read, say you should try for 10,000 steps a day at least.
And that's a really good figure to keep in mind. So it's worth considering. The number is kind of made up in a way, but if you're only walking 4,500 steps a day, physiologically, that's defined as a sedentary lifestyle, and that brings a surge of other metabolic problems. So my advice is always do 5,000 steps more than you're currently doing. So if you're doing about 4,500, well, doing an extra 5,000 will bring you up close to the 10 mark. And ideally, do some of those where you're imposing some cardiac strain so that you get some aerobic benefit from it as well.
So I always get up in the morning and I put on my map, my run, where I usually am walking. But I do 3 to 4 miles at 6 o'clock and 6:30 in the morning. And so by the time I'm back taking a shower, put my new fresh clothes on, I've already got between 6,000 and 7,000 steps in.
Which is a great. And you feel fired up for the day.
You do feel fired up for the day. And then I'm sedentary a lot because, well, for example, I'm sitting here on a chair talking with you right now. And so
I'm doing the same.
You're doing the same. But, you know, by the end of the day, I'll always check the steps to see how many I've gone. And I'll pretty much always go out for another walk in the evening. But it surprises me, even with the sedentary, with the step counter, how many steps you take you don't even realize you're taking in the course of a day, to be honest.
Yeah, and if you have to do things like take a phone call or something like that, take it on the phone. You're not tethered anymore. We don't have landlines attached to the wall. So go for a walk while you're doing that. And you can, if you take a call for maybe an hour's duration, you can sneak in 4,000 steps without even noticing it.
Let's talk about, you mentioned cities and walking, and why are some cities so walkable and others not so much? You talk about that in the book. Expand, tell us about that.
Yeah, so walkability is a really important thing where cities are concerned. And I'm sure you or your listeners have traveled to the various cities of Western Europe at some time or another. And you'll notice that some of the cities are very old. The medieval cities are very walkable cities simply because there's no room for cars. And if you were to bring cars in, you would destroy what makes those cities wonderful. So a city like Florence in Italy, for example, the central district is there are no cars in that, or in Siena or places like this. But New York, you know, a newer city is similarly a walkable city. And the key thing here is that the urban design facilitates people being on foot because of the density of things that are available to you. And streets are designed as destinations rather than thoroughfares. And you will find that in those cities that the desirable and expensive parts of the cities of course, are these places where people congregate, where people can meet up, people can see each other, people can engage in people watching. These are kind of immensely, intrinsically pleasurable things for humans to do. Humans are interested in other humans. So the walking almost arises a kind of incidentally as a result of the city design. And this is something I think is often forgotten when you look at the design of other cities. Some cities are very, very car bound. They're very, very spread out, and they're not economically intensive in the way that somewhere like New York or San Francisco or Boston might be, because they're very, very concentrated in a much smaller landmass. So, the kind of design decisions that urban planners make have an important impact on what you do. Are your sidewalks large enough? I think we've discovered in the pandemic, actually, that they're not. And in my own local suburb here, the council has started a program of widening the sidewalks to facilitate cafes and restaurants to have outdoor dining, but also to allow people to move around easily without being afraid of being hit by a passing car.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You even have that whole segment about cities and design was really interesting to me. And as you have had some comments about as we age in some communities, just the stoplights that you come to as you're walking on the sidewalk, as we age, it gets harder.
Yeah, so this is really important, where aging is concerned. As people age, you can have encroaching disability. You can have just simple slowing down because of aging. You might have frailty that comes with aging. You might have other mobility problems. People might have joint problems. They might have to use a Zimmer frame, or indeed they might even have to use a wheelchair. And when you look at crosswalks, very often the settings are designed for a young male in his early 20s who can walk at a minimum speed of 1.2 meters a second. But actually, if you're 85 or 80 or 75, typically you walk much more slowly than that. So you have this design issue where you're basically saying to people, as they get older, walking isn't for you, or mobility isn't for you. And we really need to have, as the city, or as our planet ages and as our cities get older, a kind of an inclusive approach to urban design that embraces everybody from the age of zero all the way to your 80s and 90s. And that's not something that has been happening, I think, to the extent that it could and should be. But it will have to gradually change because the planet is aging. We are getting older together.
Yeah, we are indeed. I find it interesting that you work on your writing while you're walking.
Yes, I do. One of my secrets, which I shouldn't give away, but I have. So what I do where writing is concerned is I make notes on sheets of paper, which I staple together. These are often, just very rough pieces of text, half-formed thoughts and those kinds of things. And I go for a walk with my smartphone or with a dictaphone. And I turn those into very ungainly prose. But what I often find is that I talk for much longer and end up with many more ideas than I would have done had I just simply sat there being a prisoner at my laptop. And then you end up with this big lump of prose that you can do something with. And the kind of thought at the back of that is lots of writers walk prior to writing, and lots of problem solving is facilitated because of walking. So movement prior to problem solving is a good way to solve problems.
Yeah, I loved your little comment about T.S. Eliot and his poems are great for walking. The cadence, and you have to wonder.
The rhythm.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree with you. The rhythm of his poems, you really feel like you're moving, and they're almost best to listen to. When you're walking along, listening to them on Audible or something like this.
Well, and you wonder if he didn't maybe compose a lot of those while he was walking.
I wouldn't be surprised. but this is something that I think writers and others have been alive to for generations, and it's only something that psychology and neuroscience has caught up to recently. I tell the story in my book of the great mathematician from Dublin, Rowan Hamilton, who invented quaternions, which are used in for graphics and all sorts of other things on your computer. And he used to walk from the Astronomical Observatory in North Dublin to Trinity College every day, which is a distance, I think, of about 7 or 8 miles, thinking about quaternions. And the day he discovered the quaternion equation, as he was walking along, he had no pen. He only had his tobacco knife. So he cut the formula into the bridge that he was passing so that he wouldn't forget it. And without him having done that, we might not have electric toothbrushes, and we might not have three-dimensional shoot 'em up games on our computers.
Well, that's a great story. I laughed out loud when I read that. Social walking, you know, a lot of times at 6 a.m, I don't have a lot of people walking along with me, although I do see a lot of people out and I always say hello and it's kind of social that way. But social, there's a lot of rewards to social walking.
Yeah, so I think this has been one of the things that's been overlooked or really maybe not thought about carefully enough, that our walking evolved in a social context. So how did we populate the planet? We populated it by moving in small groups, in tribes, in units of that kind of type. You know, one guy with a spear can't conquer the wilderness. No matter how much you try to do that, you must have a group with you. So we're supremely attuned to other people when we're walking. And we find the walking in the presence of others to be very pleasurable. And we do something unusual. We keep ourselves paced by singing, by chanting, by poetry, by recitation when walking. And no other species does this. So social walking is one of the great undiscovered pleasures of walking, or to be discovered pleasures of walking if you're not a walker.
Well, Shane, this has been a marvelous chat. I want to thank you so much for being with us today and also for writing the book. I found it very interesting. I learned a lot, but also was quite entertained. You're a great writer. Thank you. And I hope we have I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you.
That would be wonderful. I'd love it. Thank you, Larry.
Shane O'Mara, his book is called In Praise of Walking, and the subtext is the subtitle, I should say, is A New Scientific Exploration, published by Norton, In Praise of Walking. I think you're going to enjoy it when you certainly enjoyed talking with him. I did anyway, and I bet you did too. You know, somebody else I always enjoy talking to is Megan Hart. You know, do we do our monthly sports show? And Megan Hart, our WPR sports reporter, is back with us again to talk about the latest in Wisconsin sports. So not as much walking as a lot of running, maybe a little walking when you're playing baseball. But Megan Hart, are you there?
I am. Hi, how are you, Larry?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Busy these days.
Suffering from the Bucks play last night with the Miami Heat.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that one didn't go quite as Bucks fans were hoping. But fortunately, we'll get another chance tomorrow.
Yeah. Jimmy Butler, who, by the way, was went to Marquette. Played the game of his one of the games of his career for the Miami Heat in really taking care of the Bucks last night. It's kind of too bad. How do you think you think you're going to rebound from that?
Well, I don't see Jimmy Butler scoring 40 points every game this series. He really was incredible last night. He usually is so effective in the paint, but he just didn't miss a jump shot, it felt like. So I think the Bucks have a pretty good chance of making it a competitive series. I think They dropped game one to the Magic in the first round. This is obviously a very different story. The Heat are a much better team. And I think it was an attractive pick among a lot of sports pundits to actually pick the Heat going into this series, even though the Bucks are the top seed in the East. So I think it'll be pretty competitive, especially since no one really technically has home court advantage since they're playing in the coronavirus bubble. But after the game last night, Bucks star Giannis Antetokounmpo, he did say, they've been here before. They were here last series. Last year, they dropped game one in the Eastern Conference semifinals to the Celtics. He had 18 points. He almost had a triple-double, which is pretty good for most players, but he did not have his best night last night, and I think he will certainly rebound. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, for sure. And, of course, last week the Bucks sat out a game in support of kind of some of the events taking place in Kenosha, and that had a ripple effect across a lot of sports.
It really did. It was a really interesting day to be covering sports. That was Wednesday. I think there was, a little conversation that maybe teams would do that, but it still felt like a really big moment and a big surprise when the Bucks didn't leave the locker room for their game on Wednesday. And it really did spread across sports in an incredible way with the WNBA and Major League Baseball, the NHL, Major League Soccer canceling game or postponing games, and NFL teams postponing practices. Now college teams. Yesterday we had the University of Alabama marching their college football team behind Nick Saban, tennis players withdrawing from matches. It's really been quite the week. And Bucks players, after their game Saturday, when they beat the Magic and advanced to this second round, a lot of them talked about how this was a decision really made from the heart. It started with George Hill, who was very outspoken last week about what's going on in Kenosha. He decided not to play. When his teammates found out, they all said, I'm going to stand with my brother and I'm not going to play. They never expected it to have these kind of repercussions, but they said it's just been really humbling and meant a lot to them to see it really spread across the sports world.
Yeah, for sure. And the Brewers, of course, had that same kind of discussion and didn't play either.
They voted unanimously as a team not to play, and that felt like a big moment because that was kind of the next shoe to drop after the Bucks made that decision.
Yeah, my daughter and I think had one of the most enjoyable evenings Saturday evening watching the Brewers. As a matter of fact, that was quite a game where.
Oh my gosh!
We were. I said that's the best evening of entertainment we've had. I don't know if you watched it at all, but
I did, and it was so frustrating because I was really excited for the Brewers, excited for the game, but my TV was behind my MLB at Bat app, so I got a notification on my phone saying they hit a 2-run homer before I saw it on the TV.
Oh no! Oh, and then. Oh my gosh. And then they traded David Phelps to the Phillies. So you wondered about is a relief pitcher. But Devin Williams and Josh Hader scared the pants off me Saturday night walking five people in a row. And I wondered, how is he going to come back? I hope he comes back from that. And he certainly did last night.
That was encouraging. You don't see him make mistakes like that often. And Devin Williams has just been really impressive this season. And he did a pregame news conference, I guess it would be Thursday, and he is the only black player on the Brewers right now. And so he talked a lot about the decision they made Wednesday. And it's just been so nice to have to see him having such a great season. But he also was really, spoke so openly. And it was very interesting to hear from him.
Yeah, what's going on with Big Ten sports? There's been some talk maybe about starting football up after Thanksgiving, but do you expect teams to play at all this school year?
That is a very good question. They're looking at plans to start right now as early as Thanksgiving. I think that there are, regardless of whether they were to start in Thanksgiving or January, it obviously creates some different challenges, especially with the coronavirus pandemic. Even things like, it would be more difficult for them to practice outside, which of course is safer during coronavirus. I'm not sure that, that starting Thanksgiving or starting at the beginning of January really makes a big difference, because either way, teams wouldn't be able to qualify for the playoffs if they were to happen this year. But I think, right now some of the conversation is just suggesting that the Big Ten is trying to save face by not starting football season right away, like some of the other conferences, because they did initially make the decision to postpone until spring. And today, Donald Trump apparently called Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren, talked to him about ways that the White House could support the Big Ten having a football season starting as soon as possible. So there's a lot of moving parts there right now, but we have other, a lot of teams have dealt with outbreaks, and some teams are starting in the next couple of weeks. And so I think, at the very least, it makes sense to kind of see what happens as teams in the SEC and the ACC and the Big 12 start to play their games. And quite a few of them are even having reduced capacity crowds. So it really, it will be very interesting to see what happens there.
I would, it's amazing to me that they're able to do that. Of course, they're in a little warmer climate than most of the Big Ten teams. For one thing, so that may be a help. But when it comes to COVID, I don't think that's going to be much of a help. In fact, now just switching gears a bit, the U.S. Open tennis tournament is this weekend. How's the pandemic affecting it?
Yeah, that one hits me hard. I usually go to the U.S. Open every year, and it's my favorite sporting event. I love it. And so it's so strange to watch matches at the Billie Jean National Tennis Complex, Billie Jean King National Tennis Complex that are empty. I mean, because it has such a wonderful atmosphere most of the time. And I think yesterday we saw that actually kind of affect a couple of players like John Isner and Coco Gauff, a couple of really popular Americans who probably would have benefited from the crowds there yesterday, but they lost their first round matches. But it should be, today I think it'll be interesting. Venus and Serena are both playing. Andy Murray and Kim Clijsters are actually making their comebacks today to the U.S. Open. So I think even without the fans, it will still be entertaining to watch on TV. But it is getting, last night was pretty challenging. I'm from the Tampa Bay area, and the Lightning were playing in a playoff game the same time the Bucks were playing in a playoff game, and tennis was on. The Rays had a no-hitter going through the sixth, and it was just such a big departure from a few months ago.
And the Brewers were playing. I mean, it was,
everybody.
We went from no sports for such a long time to so many, you don't know even know where to, you need split screen TVs to watch it all. Well, Megan, it's always a pleasure. Look forward to talking to you again. Thanks so much for stopping by and visiting with us about what's going on in our Wisconsin professional and college sports. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Megan Hart, our guest. Coming up, we're going to talk about the benefits of physical education. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.